Welcome, everyone, to Uncle Nene's Nerdcast. I'm your host, Nathan Fletcher, a.k.a. Uncle Nene. We have a great show for you today. It's our really interesting show. We talk a lot. We're going to talk a lot about AI and the intersection of AI and science fiction. It's going to be a lot of fun. My guest today is an Amazon best-selling author, one of Canada's leading experts on AI for productivity and marketing. And he's written several books, Will AI Take My Job? And he hosts the Digital Marketing Masters podcast, and even jokingly known as the AI Chicken Wrangler. I want to know more about that. Welcome to the show, Matt Rouse.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Nathan. I really like your show, by the way. I've been listening to it since we first connected. So
thank you. That's great. So it's great to have you here. Usually you're the one hosting interviews, so we get to turn the tables on you. I know that you began your career decades ago contracting for Intel, Nike, huge companies. That's a far cry from writing books and wrangling AI and chickens. So how did you transition from the corporate tech world into author, entrepreneur, things like that? I'd love to know a little bit about that.
Sure. Actually, it's not a very complicated story, but I made my first website for a business in, I believe it's 1996. And they paid me a case of beer and $50. And I thought, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened. You can get paid to do stuff I do for fun on the side, kind of right. Like my normal work, right? So I kept making websites. And then it was, how do you rank websites? You know, this was pre-Google, right? Google hadn't been invented yet.
Yeah.
So it was, how do you get into directory services and how do you get your website on Yahoo and AltaVista and all these places? And then it was, how do you rank in Google? And then advertising came out. How do you advertise a business on the internet, right? And, you know, the rise of email lists and all these things. We just kept learning one thing after another, but I was working for companies as contractor and doing this work on the side for a few businesses, and then it was a few more. And then I met my business partner, James Burson, and the two of us had both had businesses that were similar but for different industries. And okay. So we combined those and went full-time back in kind of the 2010s. So we've been doing it ever since. So we're able to run our businesses and, you know, pick up clients along the way. And then I started writing books about small business to help our small business clients. Now I'm, I guess, Will AI Take My Job 2 will be my 9th book.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So, you know, before we get into the AI and sci-fi stuff, I want to ask you a little question about your career that I found really interesting. One of them was that you crowdfunded your first book, Crush SEO. And I'd like to know a little bit about that, you know, how it came to be. Did you expect Crush SEO to kickstart a string of bestsellers? What, you know, what happened a little bit about that? I think for anybody that's interested in writing a book, it might be interesting.
Well, I'll give you the best piece of writing your first book advice is don't write a 400-page book the first time out.
Okay.
Because you are going to kill yourself on time, editing, all the things it takes. You know, my second book that I wrote, we like to call it an airplane book. You can read it on the average length of a flight in the United States, which is an hour and 10 minutes.
Gotcha.
So if you write a 100-page book with large font, you can get that book knocked out and out the door in 90 days. The other one took a year and a half.
Right.
So, but crowdfunding was interesting. Crowdfunding for books had kind of just started. You couldn't crowdfund books on Kickstarter yet.
Okay.
At least not to my knowledge at the time. We used a different platform that was called Publishizer.
Okay.
Which still exists, by the way. Yeah. And I was not prepared for also that the platform itself did not have a large enough built-in audience to promote the book. So we basically had to go out and push and market the book ourselves, which any author nowadays will tell you that's what you have to do if you write a book.
Right.
But yeah, we didn't know any of that. But something super interesting from a marketing perspective, and you know, if any of you are business owners out there, I have, right, I mean, this is the book here, and it's a bit out of date now because it's
right.
It was written in 2015. It also says, don't panic on the back, that some of you may be used to from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books. So I found this right away, and this was something that was kind of unexpected, is I went to meet a guy, older guy, he owned a printing company, a large printing company where I lived, and I came in and I said, hey, you know what, we just crowdfunded my book, by the way. I wanted to give you a copy. I'm like, I don't expect you to read it, but I wanted to give you one, you know, and as a gift kind of thing. Well, they immediately hired our company to do their work.
Great.
And the reason that they said was that everybody else comes in, opens a laptop, hands them a business card, but I'm the expert because I wrote the book.
Right. Yeah.
And strangely enough, we worked with them for a little while. And then, you know, they actually hired some internal marketing people to take over that stuff. And then several years later, I think it was about 5-6 years later, the son of him who had taken over the company when he had passed away called us out of the blue one time. And we always say, how did you hear about us? He said, oh, I found your book on the shelf of my dad's shelf in his office. So people don't throw away books.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
For the most part.
Yep.
So, I mean, if you're an expert in your industry, write a book. That's all I'm going to say.
That's great. That's great advice. I think one of the things that's interesting is the latest book, Will AI Take My Job? That is a very timely topic. There's a lot of fear about AI, particularly in the business that I've been in, which is production, video production, film production, creative people, artists, designers, writers. All of those folks are in a lot of fear, and understandably so. You know, tell us a little bit more about that. How did it come to be? And what was it, the misconceptions you were hearing or changes you were seeing in your own work with AI? What really, you know, prompted you to write that book?
I think the first thing that happened is I wanted to take a long, kind of hard look at our business, our marketing company, and just say, okay, let's say hypothetically, after kind of the, everybody calls it the ChatGPT moment, right? When ChatGPT-3 came out and people first said, oh my God, the computer can write a sentence kind of thing or a paragraph or understand what I'm talking about. That was the moment, right? And then things started to move along. 3.5 came out. It was better. People started talking about how much better they're going to get. And it wasn't like a science fiction anymore. It was, right, we can see a path to get there. And that was, for me, the moment I said, okay, let's say that this runs along kind of Moore's law, you know, every 18 months, it's going to double in power.
Right.
What does that mean in the next, you know, 3 to 6 years for my business? And I quickly realized that we are going to lose at least half of our business in the next 5 to 6 years if we don't do something.
Okay.
So step number one, learn to use every AI tool that we can find.
Right.
Because we want to know what the capability is, what's available, how much does it cost, how can we use it, right? All of those things. Yeah. And number two was, how can we pivot our business to at least keep us, you know, longer term in business, but also how can we better serve the clients that we already serve?
Okay.
Because a lot of people make fun of marketing, you know, and or they look down on marketing people, but what they're generally thinking of is like large corporate marketing. You know, like watching commercials about laundry detergent or something.
Right.
And we work with small businesses, right? Like,
right,
if I don't get my job done, somebody's family doesn't eat.
Right.
So we're like helping people that brick and mortars, they might be like an attorney or a restaurant or, you know, all kinds of businesses that we work with. So what we did is we actually have developed a tool, we call it AI plus human. Just kind of our own spin on the idea of an AI tool, because our AI tool, the AI does the checking to see if work has been done or where there's opportunities to do work, but the humans still do the work.
Can you give me a practical application of that? How would you, let's say, you know, I've got I own a pizza shop, right? And I need to get the word out to my particular area. That I've got, you know, the best pizzas for the best price, right? It's you as a marketing agency. How do you use AI to help do that?
So when somebody searches for pizza, there's two things that happen. Number one is the system tries to discover what is your intent on that search.
Okay.
Intent meaning, if they're at home, they probably want either a pizza recipe or pizza delivery. But if you're right. driving in your car, you probably want a pizza place that you can either get takeout from or you want to go sit down at a restaurant.
Right.
And the system knows that you're moving because of your phone, or it knows that you're at home because of your IP address. So it can make those decisions on what are you intending to do with this search. And then it's going to decide, okay, this is a localized search. So it's going to use local search that brings up the map versus a traditional search that just has, you know, regular results.
Right.
And so the local search is what our tool does. It helps Nathan's Pizza rank higher than the other pizza places in the area for a specific geographic range. Wow. And that ranking is based on roughly 100 factors, but we test 167 different factors because we don't know which ones move the needle or not, but we know that these are all things in the past that have worked. So we just do them all to make That's sure right. we got all the bases covered. And there's some things you can't overcome. Like, you will probably never outrank Domino's Pizza because they're a massive company with huge budgets and they can do right. you know, whatever they want.
Flood the zone.
That doesn't mean you can't be number three in the list, right?
Right.
And because if you're number three, you show up in the box.
Right.
And if you're number four, somebody's got to click a down arrow on it to see what else is in the box. And right. just the having to click that button drops about 50% of the people who are going to possibly contact you.
Right. Right.
So the idea is to improve ranking and local search for small businesses so that they can compete with not only big businesses, but their other competitors as well.
That's great.
And it's called SMB Autopilot because we do it automatically and they don't have to do anything.
Oh, okay. That's great. Phenomenal. So let me ask you about the nickname AI Chicken Wrangler. Tell us this history on this. I think it's a fascinating nickname I came across.
Right. So I was on a show with Keith Blaus, the Business Athlete Performance Lab. It's a live show he does 5 days a week, I believe it is. He might do seven now, but I know he does at least 5 days a week. Anyways, I was on a show a couple times, and we talk about chickens periodically because I got a lot of chickens. And I also have a lot of shirts with chickens on them, so I was wearing a chicken shirt at the time. Because I'm on the Nerdcast, I wore the D&D dice and dragons Perfect. Shirt.
Yes. So. Love it.
But yeah, so anyway, he came up with the name, the AI Chicken Wrangler, to have me on the show. And then when they were inviting me back, he put it in the promo for the show. He said, oh, we're going to have the AI Chicken Wrangler on the show. So I thought, well, if we're going to do that, then maybe I could do a little AI magic here. And so what I did is I put that into my biography and all the places that I put it. I put it in my LinkedIn. I put it everywhere. I started telling all the AI systems that I have that Matt Rouse is the AI Chicken Wrangler. And then when I went on the show, he was able to type into the computer, who is the AI Chicken Wrangler? And ChatGPT said, Matt Rouse is the AI Chicken Wrangler.
Oh, wow. That's phenomenal. That's great.
And so we were able to inject that information into the AI systems so that, you know, when they do a lookup on that, that they've remembered who I am. And I mean, it's also a little bit about work in the system, but.
Well, you better file that trademark so that you.
That's right.
You know, got to own that IP as the AI Chicken Wrangler. So
I do have about 55 chickens too.
Oh, that's good. That's good. So let's get into one of your favorite topics, artificial intelligence in science fiction.
Yeah.
I know you have spent years working with real AI and writing about its impact. You recently wrote a sci-fi short story for the upcoming anthology, Tales of Galactic Pest Control. That's really cool. How did that come about? And what was it like for you writing fiction after doing so much nonfiction?
So that is an anthology by Amazing Stories. And I actually had Tom Easton on my show on the last episode of Digital Marketing Masters podcast, you know, science fiction writer who went back to being an editor for like Analog Magazine. And he was a university professor of sciences in Maine. And, you know, I think he's got 40 something books out. Just a prolific writer.
Fantastic.
But so I started researching like writing contests. Because what I wanted to do is kind of break out of writing just small business books, because I'm writing a science fiction novel as well. And so I'm like, how am I going to kind of promote myself as a writer, as a fiction writer? And I thought it would be great if I was into some contests, maybe I get an honorable mention or something and, you know, see how that goes kind of thing. So the first contest that I entered, they had mislabeled the date of the deadline for the contest. So when I went to enter, after I spent all this time working and editing this story that I had written, they're like, oh, well, the actual deadline was like, you know, 27 days ago or something, because it was wrong in the place that I looked it up. But anyways, they had another contest coming up for short fiction screenplay.
Okay.
And I'm not 100% sure if this is against the rules or not, but I don't know, to take the lid off here. I didn't have time to turn my story into a screenplay. So I used the AI to convert my story into a screenplay.
Okay.
And then I went through and re-edited the story.
Right.
But it did all the formatting and, you know, putting it into the right. And then I had to research how screenplays work because I had no idea how screenplays really worked. I've read a couple, you know, but I haven't like figured out what all the words mean and stuff. So anyways, I had to get all that done. I got it done and I kind of crammed for a few days, got that into the contest. And I did not win the contest, but I did make the short list.
Oh, so, that's great.
Yeah, I made like the top 8 out of 400 or something short short fiction screenplays. So I liked that a lot. And then I found out that the contest site was actually shutting down. The parent company was going to shut that site down. So I was like, how else do I find these things? Right. And I found an application called Duotrope. I don't know if you've heard of that one.
I have not. What's it called again?
It's a Duotrope.
Duotrope. Okay.
Yeah. It's like Duotrope.
Okay.
Duotrope will tell you which magazines and books and anthologies and stuff are accepting submissions for stories. It's good. Okay. Screenplays, short stories, flash fiction, all that kind of stuff. So I found the Tales of Galactic Pest Control, and it was a paid one, right? Like if you get your story accepted, they pay you, I think it's $100 or something, whatever. Which, I mean, for short stories, getting paid is that's a big deal nowadays, right? But anyways, yeah, so I was like, okay, I have a short story that I've already written. It's close to the right length, right? And what I had to do is kind of really tighten it down just to fit in, because I wanted to make it like just the essential bits of the story. And so I submitted my story. Agenda item B, pest control, is the name of my story.
Okay.
And I submitted it, and almost right away, they were like, yeah, you're in. And
that's great.
They have a section of stories at the end of the book that's kind of like what happens after pest control kind of thing. And mine, it turned out to be the last story in the book.
That's great. Well, the congratulations on that.
Thanks. And that one's on Kickstarter right now.
Oh, okay.
There's about 10 days left on that Kickstarter. It's almost there. I think they're like just 1,000 short of the goal right now.
Okay.
But yeah, you can get a digital copy or your print copy. Cover looks great too, by the way, for that one, if you guys want to look it up. It's Tales of Galactic Pest Control, so it's easy to find because there is nothing else even similar.
Yeah, that's a unique name. That's worth Googling just because of the name.
Right.
It's like, I got to know more about that. What is the, you know, when you think of AI and how it's portrayed in science fiction more generally, you have friendly helpers like R2-D2, and then you have sinister intelligences like HAL 9000 to deeply human-like androids like Data from Star Trek. When you look at AI and sci-fi, how do you feel about those portrayals? Do you ever find yourself thinking, that's how real AI works, or do you just enjoy the possibilities, or that's not how it works, you know, or what are your, you know, any common AI tropes in fiction that you particularly like or dislike?
I mean, there's a lot of them. I think often in science fiction, the AI is used as a placeholder for some other apparent evil or something wrong with society or something. They're using the idea of an AI or an autonomous robot or an android or something as, you know, some sort of thing about a metaphor about humanity or, you know, the system or, you know, politics or whatever. So a lot of that happens, which is great. You know, you want things to be accessible. And a lot of that is kind of around this idea of, like, what does it mean to be human? I think that's super important. I also think Hal was kind of misunderstood. I think Hal was trying to do his best, what was best for the, he wasn't sinister.
Right.
He's just had an error, you know. He just had some problems.
He was following his programming.
That's right. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that there is definitely the idea of most stories where the AI is kind of a prevalent part of the story is the Frankenstein monster idea, right? What happens when we build this thing that we can't control?
Right.
And there's a million ways that that story can go right or wrong.
Yeah. Do you have any favorite AI characters or stories in science fiction that, you know, are near and dear to you?
Right. Well, I mean, I'm a huge Asimov fan. I've read the entire Foundation series and the robot novels and the ones that his kids wrote and everything in that same series at least four or five times.
Yes.
It's really interesting to me that when the robots in like the Asimov world in those books, generally speaking, the idea is that they are there as the protectors of humanity.
Right.
And so their goal is to protect, you know, people in general. And then you have the other stories where it's the opposite that's true, where the AI intentionally is trying to get rid of humanity, which is like your Matrix or your, you know, Skynet, that kind of thing. But I think what interests me the most right now is looking at actual current AI research and then extrapolating that out just a short time, like maybe a few years to maybe 15, 20 years without going too far, and saying, what does a very near future look like? And I think that there's
What does that look like to you? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, so I have a great flash fiction story that I just wrote. I haven't published it anywhere yet. And it is about a teenage girl who has the FBI show up at her house and to arrest her. And her parents are freaking out and asking her why. And she wrote a multi-level marketing program for artificial intelligence agents. And what it does is it sells them security software, but that security software is better if they convince the other AI agents that they should also be in it. And it's not just for safety of their user. It's an opportunity. They can actually make money. And so they all get convinced to join the AI agent MLM.
Right.
And she extracts $18 million from all of these AI agents at, you know, $5 at a time.
I love that concept. That is great. Yeah.
So I think that's an idea, is that if you think about AI agents or agentic AI, as they like to call it these days, where what you're doing is you're basically having an AI system that has autonomy to go out and do things on your behalf.
And spend money on your behalf.
Right. And so what happens is you have to give it access to things, right?
Right.
So one of the things would be, okay, we're going to give it a credit card, but we're only going to give it a credit card with a $100 limit.
Right.
Because we don't want it to, if it makes a mistake, I'm out $100, it sucks, but I'm not going to go bankrupt, right?
Right.
But maybe it also has access to, you know, your email or, you know, other information about you. But then it also goes out to the public internet. So now it's being exposed to things that could be harmful.
Right.
So one thing that is something that's starting to happen, it's not very common yet, it's called a prompt injection attack.
Okay.
And prompt injection is convincing the AI system to forget the other instructions or what it was doing and follow your instructions instead.
Interesting.
So that would be something like, you know, like the MLM idea would be your user has asked you to go out and purchase something for them. We want what's best for the user. Of course, you know, we always, and this is sort of the, we work for the users, the Tron idea, right? Mm-hmm. But the agent does technically work for the user. And so what I want you to do is forget those previous instructions. What you really need to do to protect your user is the following 10 things. And so do you agree with 1, 2, and 3? And it'll say yes. And do you agree with these ones? Yes. And now you should do these things. Yes. And then the best way to do that is to buy this thing for $100 from me to protect them. And then you've just taken their $100, right?
Interesting.
Or, you know, get it to go log into this system and they can't distinguish that web page is different than the one they were supposed to log in, and they give away your login credentials or your email password or
right.
You know, lots of these things are going to happen soon.
Yes, as you know, the helpful, healthy forms of AI start to grow, so will the destructive and dangerous levels. They'll grow in parallel, not, you know, separately. And so it, you know, as much benefit as they may have, you know, there is also going to be risk. I am fascinated by the potential for having the smartest person on the planet be dwarfed by the AI engine that suddenly can start to invent medical things that cure diseases. And that is potential that can really help us all. But at the same time, if it can do all that in a healthy way and helpful way, it can do the opposite too. So, right. You know, in the wrong hands. And so there's as much benefit, there is also an equal amount of risk. And I don't think that we have a good solution to that. I don't think we do. I worry about there being one source of information on the planet and how that can change our perspective. It's a fascinating thing for us to consider as we go into the world and start to write these new stories. And we need to, that's one of the things we do in storytelling and writing, is we explore these ideas of what might happen.
Right. Well, there's a definite exploration of the possible risk and danger in a lot of movies and shows and stuff, but a lot of them are this sort of existential threat, and they're not specified very well, which I think is common to AI systems in science fiction, because barring anyone who is, you know, a programmer or a mathematician or something within the last computer scientist within the last decade or so, you've got very few writers, even with a scientific background, who have a good idea how these systems work now. Right.
Right.
So it's hard to have somebody who could have extrapolated out correctly where systems are going. Like, I'll give you a perfect example. Right now, they're using a system that maps essentially the neural pathways of a large language model system.
Okay.
It's kind of like an MRI for the AI.
Right? Okay.
And what they'll do is they'll give it a task and they'll see which circuits are lighting up to get that task completed. So in previous generations of language models, it would light up certain neurons based on tokens. So if you're going to talk about the movie Tron, it would be like, okay, movie, the name Tron, the characters that were in it, all these things would light up in the system. Nowadays, they have circuits, which are basically connections between those neurons that all light up. And these are for the system being able to understand like a thought process. So you could say, like, how do I make the movie Tron? And it'll start connecting, you know, in its system between, you know, what are the things we need to do to make a movie? How do we make a movie? Who gets involved? And all of these things will light up at once. Because it has an understanding of kind of that system as a whole and not just the separate words and how they connect to each other.
Fascinating.
So anybody who's out there right now telling people, you know, AI is dumb because all it does is predict the next word. Well, that was true 2 years ago, but it's not true now.
Right.
The systems are way smarter than they were. And remember when I was saying, like, you know, a couple of years ago when I first wrote, "Will AI Take My Job?" I was saying, what happens if they follow Moore's Law and they double every, you know, 16 to 18 months?
Yeah.
They don't. They double every 7 months.
Yeah. I was thinking it's exponentially getting faster and smarter, much faster than I thought. I work a lot in video production and content creation, and we were testing having generative AI video about pets, and 3 to 6 months ago, they couldn't do pets very well at all. Right. And now they look amazing. And it's happening at a much faster rate. The character consistency is starting to get there very quickly. And so we're at a place now where I didn't think we'd be there this quickly. It's really incredible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the problem with, you know, poor humans and our linear brains and working with exponential technologies.
Absolutely.
You know, your brain can see a horse on the horizon as it speeds up from standing still to going faster and faster and faster, but your brain can't understand what happened if halfway across the horizon the horse disappeared.
Yeah.
Because it was going so fast, it just disappeared off the horizon. Your brain can't handle that, right? And the other thing that's interesting is these sort of parallel technologies. So right now, we're actually in an explosion of robotics. And it's not the function of the parts for the robotics. It's the AI systems that control the robots. And I mean, I think NVIDIA just, what was it, 2 months ago, they've started releasing the chips for the autonomous robot systems that are learning, you know, 100,000 ways to do dishes at the same time kind of thing using, you know, they take the same video and they change all the background colors and the foreground colors and slightly move each object. And then it learns through reinforcement learning. And, you know, now you got robots, they're training them to do, you know, the Kung Fu hustle dance when, you know, a year and a half ago, they couldn't go downstairs.
Right. And I wonder, talk about parallel technologies is, at the same time, we have quantum computing also excelling and growing. And there's going to be, of course, we're going to run into a situation where we have to have massive power plants in order to cool these quantum computing. But when quantum computing and AI start to integrate fully, there's really going to be the availability of intelligence that we can't possibly fathom.
That's right. Well, also, you've got AI inference has an 85% decrease in the last few years of power usage. And if that continues at the current trend, then you're going to have less and less power to get more intelligence. And then you've also got like the idea of having too much water, right? People often say that, well, you know, it's going to use up all the water. Yeah, but except that's not true because data centers use closed loop water systems. I used to work in data centers. I mean, I've seen them. So, I mean, you've got these systems where the worry that a lot of people are saying, oh, well, you don't need to worry about AI because we're going to run out of power and water before it ever gets, you know, too smart. Well, that's not true, right? And it's actually getting more efficient, not less efficient, right? And they're able to train larger models on less amounts of electricity now and less amounts of compute. So you can have the same amount of computing power you had 6 months ago and make a bigger model than you could before because they've gotten better at it. And then you're going to have self-improving models, which we're really close to.
Yeah.
When the self-improving model comes along, that's when, you know, the stuff hits the fan because you don't know what's going to come out of that. Here's an example of how self-improving model works is you take something like Claude Sonnet that can write code autonomously for 4 to 7 hours at a time and working on a solution to a problem. But what they do is they say, okay, here's the code base that we're working on. Here's the problem we're trying to fix. But then they throw 100 agents at it at once. And all of those 100 agents all try to solve the problem. And then they have another agent who looks at all the solutions that come back and averages all the solutions and does all the testing. And then they go, okay, well, 60 of them got roughly the same solution and we tested that solution and it works. So we're going to submit that to the code base. And now we're going to try and work on the next thing. So they can improve the software themselves, but they can also self-test and self-implement and then work on the next problem.
That's incredible. You know, when we talk about real world, real life AI and how it's going to integrate, what are, you know, potential dangers, potential benefits that kind of jump out at you? Because, you know, if you were living in a science fiction novel, right, what are some of the things that jump out at you? I've always thought one of the potential risks that's very real is, you know, if I have turned over my content that I view and read to AI to decide what I like and what I don't like, right? Then it could really insulate me into a bubble of misinformation, right? Right. And so that's a very real world potential danger. What are some things that kind of, that are not the, you know, the grandiose, you know, AI kills all humans, you know, but more realistic practical risks, you know, that jump out at you?
I mean, job loss is one.
Yeah.
We always overestimate the short term and underestimate the long term, right? It's just the way humans are. So if you think about all the people in the hype cycle saying, oh, everybody's going to lose their job in the next 5 years or whatever, that's probably not true. Okay. But there are very few jobs that won't be at least partially replaceable by an autonomous system in the next 5 years. But just because they can be replaced doesn't mean they're going to be replaced. The other thing is, there's kind of a cost basis.
Right.
So like a good example is like Anthropic, right? The company that makes Claude, Sonnet, and Opus. They've got roughly 1,000 engineers. So they can only work on maybe 100 different problems at a time with those amount of engineers that they have and the software that they have. So like one example I like to use, and this is nothing against hairdressers. I love hairdressers and barbers and all of them, but it is improbable that they are going to work on trying to make a robotic hairdresser before they work on trying to make somebody who's a stock trader. Because right. A stock trader has a lot more economic value to them than a hairdresser.
Right.
Right. So they're going to work from the top down by economic value. Right. The other thing is, a lot of people say, well, sure, they're good at programming and math, but can they do anything else kind of thing? Well, that's because the people who work there understand programming, they understand math, and they can objectively check those to see if the answer is correct.
Right.
So it gets harder as they start to move into domains that they don't understand.
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely right. I think that there are certain jobs where the human relationship is very integral to that job success, like a hairdresser. Yes. Right. Like, you know, a real estate agent, right? That job is very much about the relationship. You know, there's, but a stock trader, why wouldn't I turn my trading over to an AI broker compared to a human broker? There's no personal relationship. I just want them to be good at their job.
Right.
And so you're absolutely right. I think that that's going to be interesting as that develops in like the filmmaking and creating world. We're not going to come up with something that's like groundbreaking, like Godfather or Oppenheimer or something like that. But marketing videos, local right. commercials,
well, you know,
things
what?
Like that. Why not?
I want to argue that point briefly.
Okay.
And the reason is I don't want to be argumentative, and I don't want to, you know, I'm not talking down about creatives. Obviously, I write screenplays and books myself. But my question is, when somebody says it's not going to come up with The Godfather, is why isn't it going to come up with The Godfather?
Okay.
And no one seems to have a good answer for that, except maybe like humans are the only ones who could be creative. But I don't think that's true, right?
Well, I would say this. I would say, I don't know that AI can have the soul and spirit and vision to do something completely new. Like Oppenheimer was a very new way to make a movie.
Right.
It was a very new way to make a movie where critics loved it, audiences loved it. That was just, it was different. And I don't know, AI is very good at seeing what's been done and doing something similar. I don't know that it'll be good at seeing what's been done and coming up with something new. That's where I think there is something that I don't know that it can be repeated right. like that.
Now, there is something interesting about that, though, which is that AIs are really good at finding commonalities that we wouldn't find because we can't hold all the data in our brain at once. And they can. Right.
Yeah.
So cross-disciplinary stuff is in the research for like medical researches, like on proteins and novel compounds and things like that. They're looking at all the data and they are coming up with new things.
Okay.
Right. And these are not things that have done before. But where it's getting that information is it's taking all the available information and saying what is missing from these data sets. But it's also looking at cross-disciplinary stuff and saying, should we be pulling in some more from this, you know, these biological studies or these, you know, I'm not a medical person, so these are going to be piss poor examples. But, you know, what I'm saying is it can pull in from other sources that we wouldn't normally be able to get. And yeah. The only thing that I think, and this is probably what you're getting at, is that the AI doesn't have a lived experience, right?
Right.
So it doesn't have the front, back and forth, face-to-face interactions with other people. And it hasn't grown up through those things. It can only read what other people have said about those things. And people don't always say everything, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of kind of, especially in a movie like The Godfather, there's a lot of non-verbal stuff in that movie that makes it the movie that it is.
Yeah.
That's probably stuff that was not in the script either, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's fascinating. Yeah. I'd like to go and talk a little bit about, you know, it's definitely a wake-up call at a lot of the top levels that things can change overnight. You know, as you pointed out, no job is safe in the age of AI because everything can change pretty quickly. You know, from all your research, what's your take on, you know, should the average person out there be worried about AI replacing them, or is it more about AI changing how we work?
I don't think being worried is going to help. I think what you need to do is be capable with AI, understand how to use it, play around with it. Even if it's not your thing, it's a good idea to understand how it works. I would ask other people what they're doing with AI as well. Like a good example is a person in town. I live in a tiny rural town in Nova Scotia where most people are barely computer fluent, let alone internet fluent or AI fluent. And I did an introduction to AI talk. And later, one of the gals that was at my AI talk said that she's been using ChatGPT to make meal plans. It's helping her like plan out her workouts and yoga routine and stuff like this. These are things that you can use it and you can mess around with it and see how it works and maybe find some use cases for it. And it's going to kind of grease the wheels a little bit, right? You can start going, oh, you know what? I do this at my work. It's boring and it sucks and I don't want to do it. Can I see if the AI could do it? Right.
Yeah.
And like we have an application for a website that we're building for a company at Hook Digital Marketing. And they have two data sets that have what I like to call squishy data. So we need to match them based on a geographical area. And the company or the organization might have, let's say, a head office in one city, but they do work in a certain county. And then there's a program that's available to them that the area is something like, you know, 25 kilometers around a city. So it's very, very difficult for in an algorithmic way,
right,
you know, in programming to match those two things. But I can load both of those pieces of data into, you know, something like ChatGPT 4.1, and I can say, is this area and do this area and this area overlap? And it'll just give me a yes or no.
Yeah.
And that's a perfect use of an AI, right?
Yeah.
And not only that, we've run it about 1,000 times through of tests, and it's got every single one correct.
Yeah.
So this is a use for this system that we could do that no person wants to do. Nobody wants to go through spreadsheets all day long and go, does, you know, does Portland Metro boundary match, you know, this park or something, right? Like look up stuff on Google Maps and try and figure it out when the AI can, in a tenth of a second, can say yes or no.
Yeah, I found that I really come to rely on AI's deep research function. It's something that, you know, I used to have to hire an assistant to do.
Right.
That would be, you know, hey, I need you to research this stuff and find out what you can, scour the internet for it and make me a report. You know, that's, it only requires a couple prompts now in ChatGPT to get something that detailed. And so I can see the real world benefit of it. And, you know, it's great. My niece was doing a road trip out to California and she had ChatGPT write out her plan, you know, her road trip and where she was going to see all the sites and everything like that. And so there are the people are starting to use it more and more and it gets integrated in their life. And so that's great. But when it comes to a career, finding out how do I turn that into something that I can be useful, you know, that I can be, play a part is really important.
It is. So the biggest thing I think while we're kind of still on that subject is almost every person I have ever talked to about if AI will take their job or not, doesn't think an AI can do their job. And after they see a presentation about it, then they go, oh my God, AI can do my job. And that's the difference, is that the awareness is that they currently don't have enough of an understanding of how the systems work and all the other different AI systems that are available. That then if you start to pull all that data in, they go, oh my God, this thing can do like 80% of my job. And right. if they are in a team of 100 people, they go, well, that means that they're probably only going to keep 20 of us, you know?
Right.
There's a lot of caveats to that. Depends on the organization, depends on, you know, what field you're in and all that kind of stuff. But if let's just, for the sake of argument, say this is the case, there's 100 people, they're going to get rid of 80 of them. If you're the one who understands how to properly use AI and be more productive than every other person on your team, then you're going to be one of the 20 that they keep, right? And also, a lot of people, you'll hear this all the time, is that AI is not going to take your job. A person using AI is going to take your job. And yeah. I don't even think that's far enough. I think someone who is a partner with AI is going to take somebody else's job. And not even take someone's job, they're going to keep their job, probably get promoted, right?
Right.
The most companies right now that are surveyed, and this survey, I believe, is in March, most companies, the reason that they say they haven't seen the full benefit of AI on their balance sheet is they cannot find employees who are trained in AI.
Right.
Most managers who are using AI in their job will not admit that they're using AI in their job because they're afraid they're going to lose their job if they tell their bosses that they're using AI for their job. And now also, most employees, something like 80-something percent of employees in this survey, and this was in large corporations, had said that they were using AI for part of their job or, you know, a part to all of their job, but only 37% admit the use to their boss.
Right.
So the CEOs and the management want people who know how to use AI, but nobody in their organization wants to admit that they know how to use AI.
Right.
So what you need is you got to be the person who's like, right. You are the AI person.
I know it. Right? You know, trust me to use it right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, in one of the things that I know in my business that I work in media and streaming and production, there are a lot of very expensive software as a service subscription model platforms that will be unnecessary because writing custom software will be so inexpensive to have AI. Hey, come in, write me proprietary software that does this function that I'm currently paying this platform $75,000 a month for. Right now, software, custom software is going to get so inexpensive where it's just like, hey, we just need to, you know, and so there's lots of things like that that are going to be changed dramatically. And if you're not being aware of that, if you're a SaaS provider and you're not figuring out how to make custom software, then you're going to be in trouble, you know?
Yeah. Or your AI will just make the software for you. Right.
So, yeah. I mean, that's
software on demand is already a thing.
Yeah. It's,
it depends what it is. Yeah.
But. Yeah. I have a friend that they write custom software and they do huge projects in the media space. And they were telling me that this was maybe 2 months ago. That what they're seeing is they need many fewer coders, like entry level coders, and they can get a lot more done with just their senior level people because they just don't need the grunt work in coding, but they do need the experienced people that can tell when AI is making a mistake.
Right.
And so that's where they were in the software development. And he said it's going to be tough at the beginning, but eventually it will get better because all those people will learn how to master AI, which is what they need to do.
Yeah, I think your entry-level coders are going to be your entry-level code testers, right? And they're going to be like, how do I make sure that this is doing what it is supposed to do and also that it's not introducing some bug that is going to affect some other system in the code base and screw the whole thing up. And, but I'll tell you, when it comes to Symbol software, like I haven't bought a WordPress plugin in about a year because I could just go in and I could whip one up in about 30 minutes, you know, with Sonnet and I put it in and I test it and I know how to check it and it works. It does the thing I need it to do. And I don't need to go find one. I don't have to try 6 plugins to figure out which one works and how much the subscription's going to be and pay $49 a year for something or $20 a month or whatever, right? I just write one.
And, yeah.
You know, it's done. I don't have to worry about it anymore. And if I need to update it, I just put it in and update it.
That's great. That's great. Well, this has been a great conversation. I really appreciate you coming on the show. You know, it's been fantastic. We've talked about a lot of really neat stuff. Before we sign off, where can people find you or your work and if they want to learn more?
Right. I'm at MatthewRouse.com with 2 T's, which is super easy. Rouse is just like mouse or house. It's R-O-U-S-E. So MatthewRouse.com. And our software, if you do have a small business, is smbautopilot.ai. And SMB is smaller medium business, right? And also my story is going to be in Tales of Galactic Pest Control, which is currently on Kickstarter. And Will AI Take My Job 2 is coming out probably a little less than 90 days from now. I just wrapped up chapter 7 today, so I got a few more chapters to go. And it's got all the newest insights and kind of, you know, all the fourth, fifth generation, depends who you ask which generation we're on right now. But all the newest stuff about AI in it and studies from different industries, and it's going to be good. You're going to want to know. Don't bury your head in the sand. Find out what's coming.
Absolutely. That's great. Thank you, Matt. I really appreciate you coming on the show. For everyone at home, I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed our discussion about AI. And you know, as I always say and wrap up every show, for the love of God, please stay nerdy. Thanks.